is via telephone. The case is Redmacher versus United States. Counsel, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Jeff Campbell on behalf of the appellants, Redmacher. This is the first time I've had oral argument by phone, so I'm a little uncomfortable with this process. In any event, there are two issues that we wanted to address. One is the res judicata, and the other is the denial of leave to amend on the declaratory relief claim for easement rights on the Redmacher's former property. With regard to the res judicata issue, the first point I wanted to raise and point out to the court that there is no final judgment that has been entered in the Redmacher 1 case, which is the basis of the res judicata determination. That case is still pending, and there has been no final judgment entered in that case. There was an appeal taken in that case from the order granting a motion for partial summary judgment and directing possession of the property be turned over to the government. However, that was an interlocutory order appeal from what was in effect a preliminary injunction entered by the district court. I think most significantly, the district court never entered an FRCP 54B judgment on less than all claims, which possibly could have made that determination final.
But counsel, this is Judge Rawlinson.
Yes.
What do you make of our case law that says if a court treats a judgment as final for all intents and purposes, it becomes final?
Well, I don't believe the court has treated it as final because we're still going through status conferences and preliminary injunction, pretrial conferences and everything in the underlying case. I think as a practical matter, the Redmachers could move at this time to amend the answer that they have filed to include an APA-based appeal as a counterclaim based on the court's procedural status of that underlying decision. The reason why we filed a separate action, though, arose out of this court's opinion in the first appeal in Redmacher, in which this court found that the APA challenges, which have been raised in response to the motion for summary judgment, were collateral to the issues being raised in Redmacher 1. And our reading of that was that this court was finding that there was no subject matter jurisdiction over those that were in effect counterclaims under 7 U.S.C. Section 699. Because this court indicated that, since the statute of limitations had not yet run on the APA-based appeal under 7 U.S.C. 699, based on what I understood the direction or directive of this court, this Redmacher 2 case was filed that was a direct 7 U.S.C. 699. And it's on that basis then the government moved to dismiss, saying, well, these claims could have been raised in the prior case.
Mr. Campbell, if we were to agree with you and allow you to assert your APA claim now, wouldn't that call into question this court's judgment in Redmacher 1? Wouldn't the matters on which the court did decide against your client have to be reopened or be subject to challenge? Isn't that what we meant by it couldn't be collaterally challenged? It could only be directly challenged by an APA claim, which you failed to raise in Redmacher 1?
I don't believe so. I think that the decision that the federal government can still go back and try to get an FRCP 56B1B judgment in that case to finalize the decision. I don't think that there's been a final resolution for purposes of res judicata. So I'm not sure exactly how to respond to that. This court has held in Coleman and the Adams case, which are cited on page 15 in our footnote 2, that we should have been allowed to raise these in Redmacher 1, and we thought we had, and the magistrate judge and the district court apparently thought we had, but then we never got a review on the issues that we raised on appeal. I think under the doctrine of the law of the case, we should be allowed to proceed with what the court said we should do, which is bring a direct action. why I filed that the way we did.
Why didn't you simply file the APA and Rademacher 1 as a counterclaim?
Well, I looked at that option in terms of an amendment to the answer at following this court's decision in Rademacher 1, but because of the direction in the court's opinion, I thought that the court was indicating we had to bring it as a separate direct action.
But even after this court's decision in Rademacher 1, why should the district court have allowed you to amend your complaint, since you had already challenged the substance of the Agriculture Department's determination on the valuation of the property?
I'm not sure they would have allowed that because, as I indicated, they have ruled it, and as you noted, they have ruled on that issue. However, I think we have a right to have an appeal from that determination, and this court said we're not going to look at our issues raised on that because it was collateral. When the court says it's collateral, that tells me, to my mind, that means that res judicata doesn't apply. So my clients are getting sort of whipsawed between the lower court and this court, and this was the direction I thought that the court was indicating that Rademacher 1 should be undertaken.
Counsel, if you thought that you could not amend your complaint in Rademacher 1 following this court's decision because it would be barred, why do you think that you could file a separate docket number and have that heard?
Because the court indicated in its decision that the appeal on the APA grounds under 7 U.S.C. 699 had to be brought as a direct action in the federal court. That's in the first memorandum opinion. And that was the basis of my decision. As I indicate, though, I think, frankly, at this time procedurally, I could still go back to, if it was not collateral, and if this court finds that it is not collateral, if it was directly involved in the prior case, I think at this point, since there has been no final judgment, theoretically, we could still move to amend. But I think, based on this court's prior ruling, this is the better way to proceed and allow us to go ahead and try this thing. This claim is not time-barred. The other issue that I did raise, and I just wanted to point out, was that we believe there was an error on the denial of our right to amend as to our Declaratory Relief Act claim on easement rights. frankly, I didn't put the correct subject matter jurisdiction statutes in, and was relying partially on the Declaratory Relief Act, which does not form a basis for subject matter jurisdiction. The government moved to dismiss based on the fact that those were not correct jurisdictional statutes. It indicated, though, in its response that there likely was jurisdiction under the Quiet Title Act, but for specificity would be required. I mean, the counterclaim. We believe under Chang and the Simtac case that we cite on page 17 that the district court and the magistrate judge, unless it was clear that there could be no, that the complaint could not be saved by amendment, should have allowed us to amend.
Counsel,
the government's argument indicated
counsel,
that there was, yes.
Did you file a motion for leave to amend?
No, because what we did was we filed an objection to the denial or lack of a grant of leave to amend. We felt that under Chang and Simtac, if the court was required to allow us to amend, unless it could determine that there was no way to save the complaint.
So your argument really is that the court had to sua sponte give you leave to amend?
Yes, because it was clear from the record and the government's response that the amendment would save the complaint.
What's your best case authority for the proposition that the court was required to sua sponte allow you an opportunity to amend?
I think Chang and Simtac cases that we're citing set forth the general rule.
Not on sua sponte leave to amend?
That's the way I read those two decisions.
All right. Would you like to save some time for rebuttal?
I'm done, Your Honor.
All right.
Mr. Campbell, before you stop, please thank the judge in Medford for accommodating us so that both that you could have your case heard and delaying his trial.
I will do so.
Thank you.
This is Jim Sutherland. I represent the government in this matter. I'd like to respond briefly to a couple of matters that were raised in the prior brief. The rat makers have, in their submission to this court, have consistently characterized the original rat maker decision as a decision for a preliminary injunction. That's not the case. In the first rat maker case, the government filed a summary judgment on non-monetary issues. That was the issue that was presented to the court. That's what the court ruled upon. And in the Ninth Circuit opinion, this court recognized that it was an appeal from grant of summary judgment. So to characterize this as a plenary injunction is simply not correct. The trial court did not go through the balancing process you normally would on a plenary injunction. It ruled on the merits. And then that merit decision was appealed. When the court ruled on the merits, it's somewhat difficult to follow the briefing, but the briefing went something like this. The government made their motion for summary judgment. Mr. Campbell, on behalf of his clients, responded and in part argued that the court had jurisdiction to consider an attack on the administrative determination under three bases. One of those bases was an APA review. The government came back in the reply memorandum and said, yeah, that's right, but it's a review on the administrative record, and it's an arbitrary and capricious standard. The trial court, Judge Cooney, then went ahead and ruled on that basis, and he made a ruling on the merits on applying the APA standards. As I understand the record, the ratmakers then appealed that matter, and this court and admittedly, a brief opinion affirmed that the trial court. There is no discussion in this court's appellate decision on the APA review, but it's inferred, if you look at the last paragraph, that the court had to rule upon that and affirm it. I've made an argument in my briefing that not only is that a final judgment because there's no further review of that court's, of the original court's decision, but it also became the law of the case. The matter was fully briefed, the trial court decided on the merit, and this court affirmed that ruling. I've also cited a recent case that talked about a situation where an appellate court affirms the case on a basis different than what the trial court did, whether or not that has raised to that effect. I think those same standards apply. The second issue I want to make is that the grant makers have raised an issue about the four-part test on identity of claims. In my original motion in the second case, Rademacher, I cited Norhorn versus Landis Corporation, which set forth those same four-part tests. The Rademachers did not file a response to the motion dismissed in the second case. They just didn't respond. That notwithstanding that I had satisfied our local rule requirements and called consultant Mr. Campbell beforehand. In the objection that Mr. Campbell filed to have his clients, he filed a 24-page exception. Only about three pages dealt with substantive issues, and he did not argue identity claims or the four-part test. In the briefing that followed in the district court, that same standard or the same thing happened. In the appeal to this court, the only ground raised in the opening brief of the appellant was that the judgment was not final. And that the other argument was that he couldn't have brought it, and I think he conceded that that's not the case, that in Coleman and Adams he could have. It's not until he filed a reply brief that he raised the argument about the four-part test on identity claims. As I understand the rule, generally that means that arguments raised the first time in a reply brief are deemed waived and the court won't consider them. But I'm prepared to respond to the merits of those four elements in any event. There is an identity claim in this matter. The trial court in Rademacher 1 actually decided the APA standard to allow this second action to proceed when, in fact,
allow a court or expose that ruling to second guessing. It's actually the same evidence. It's exactly the same evidence because the evidence in both cases is limited to the administrative record. And there's no question that there was not an adequate administrative record in the first case. They evolved the same right. The central issue, as this court's appellate decision recognizes, is what the capitalization right or rate is. And that's the same right that's evolved in clearly the same factual situation.
Mr. Sutherland, this is Judge Alarcon. What's your response to Mr. Campbell's argument that the earlier case is not final and therefore res judicata doesn't apply?
It seems to me, Judge, that this is as final as it can get, and that's why I cite the law of the case doctrine. You had a trial court decision on the merits. This is where the judge went through and analyzed the APA standard and reviewed it. There was an appeal, and this court had jurisdiction.
Now, was that jurisdiction under 54B?
No, I had jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1292A.
Okay.
An injunction.
Yes.
And I cite the Dare and the Levine case for those propositions. So the court had jurisdiction in this matter and ruled on it. Now, you know, as a practical matter, it would have been better if the first appellate decision had discussed the APA review. But that was raised in the briefs, and they made a final decision, and that's a final judgment. I would argue, Your Honor, that the law of the case would require the trial court judge and any subsequent appellate court to abide by that underlying ruling.
Mr. Sutherland, this is Judge Bidey. What remains in Rademacher 1?
I'm sorry.
The case is still open. Why is it still open? What's left to decide?
The monetary damages, and what we've done is we've stated the case. There is a claim that there was
monetary damages for the United States.
Yes, for the
holdover on the lease.
Pardon me?
For the holdover on the lease.
Judge, I apologize. Can you break it up? I can't hear the question.
Am I on my cell phone? Is this the damages for the holdover on the lease? Is that the problem?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's the only issue that's remaining, and quite frankly, we've discussed about waiving that or not, and we're seeing what happens in this case. And I guess the final point I have on the amendment issue, Your Honor, is that the problem with Mr. Campbell's argument is that, as I see it, is that the court didn't have anything to rule on. Mr. Campbell seems to fault Judge Cooney. But there was no motion and no suggestion before Judge Cooney when he prepared his finding recommendation that there was an appeal. There is a suggestion in the objections to the finding recommendation that should have been allowed, and you know, quite frankly, under Rule 15, he has a right to appeal a motion dismissed and not respond to pleading. But the court had nothing to rule upon, and the Stewart case that I cited in the brief was, I think, exactly on point. Tell the court it had something before it to rule upon. There was nothing that the court could make a judgment about. And I think this case is controlled by the two cases I've said in my memorandum. Unless the court has any questions, I have nothing further.
Any questions?
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued stands submitted. The next case on calendar for argument is Kim versus Barnhart.
Can you get her attention? The clerk.